right, that's right. It's the second episode ever of the Revolutionary Sports Show. Brian Duchesne and Corey Sullivan here. We're going to start off by talking about the WNBA draft. Just the lottery picks, of course. The top four picks. Number one, Brittany Griner out of Baylor. Went to the Phoenix Mercury, who was 7-27 in the regular season. Ouch, they need some big-time help that Griner might be able to give them. Elena Delladon went to the Chicago Sky. They were 14-20. They weren't real bad, but she's going to help them tremendously, so watch out for that. Skylar Diggins went to the Tulsa Shock. She was out of Notre Dame. They were 9-25 last year. And fourth, Taylor Hill out of Ohio State went to the Washington Mystics, who, yes, they were 5-29 last year. So the worst team on the list got the fourth pick. That's the beauty of the lottery draft, I guess, for the top three teams they got to draft. They weren't even that bad, but Washington, ouch. But let's take a look at these numbers here. Washington, 12th offensively, last in the league. Rebounds, 11th, second to last. Assists, 10th, third to last. Then defensively, they were 9th. And they pick up Taylor Hill, who averaged 20.4 points per game. Second in free throws made, second in free throws attempted. And she's a 5'10 guard, which should help him out offensively. And assists, she can get some good assists, help the team a little bit. But then you have Phoenix, who got Griner. They weren't that bad. Rebounds, they were already second, so I expect them to move up to first after Griner enters their team. Offensively, 9th. Assist, 12th. Griner doesn't really assist too much because she's so dominant, 2.4 assists per game. Defensively, they were 12th, and Griner is just a blocking machine, so they are going to get better. And Chicago, 8th offensively, 4th rebounding, 8th assists, and defensively 3rd. And that was a good pickup. They got Delladon, who is a great offensive player, 26 points per game, 48.7 field goal percentage, and 45.2 3-point field goal percentage. Free throw percent, 92.1%. And then Tulsa got Diggins, who was 17.1 points per game, 6.1 assists per game, 3.1 steals per game, 81% from the free throw stripe, and 36% beyond the arc. And Tulsa, offensively, 7th, rebounding 12th, assist 11th, and defensively 11th. Diggins is going to help out on offense and assists, and of course steals, but she's not really going to help out rebounding. So, Corey, do you think this was good for all these teams to make these picks, or do you think it was a surprise kind of the way the order went?
I think that Chicago definitely won out. I mean, they missed out on Griner, but adding a player like Elena Delladon is tremendous for this team. You know, she's an offensive threat, and really that's their only weakness is on offense, and I can't even really say that offense is a weakness for them. So, you know, they add a 6'5 and forward from Delaware, one of the best players in the league for the NCAA, and they have the playoffs to look forward to. They finished, 14-20? That should only increase with a better offensive player. It might take her a little while to adjust to the league, but once that happens, they should be, you know, a playoff team or in championship caliber in no time. Same with Phoenix. Adding Griner is big. She's 6'8 monster. She's, you know, is a man child, if you will, you know. So adding her length, and she averaged, 5 blocks a game as a collegiate athlete?
Close to 5, yeah.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. It's like a Nerlens Noel, but the girl version of
Nerlens.
Exactly. Except Griner definitely dominated the NCAA Women's League, now in the WNBA. It wasn't really a surprise when she went number one. We've been expecting her to go number one for, 2 years now?
Two or three years now.
That was pretty much in stone that she was going to go number one. But the 2 and 3 picks were what surprised me. It was Diggins or Delladon. You could take 2 or 3. And then when you kind of look at it, Chicago, they didn't need a whole lot of help because they're 14-20. They need a little bit of a boost. But compared to the other teams who are 7-27, 9-25, and 5-29, it's not really a surprise that Delladon went to Chicago because they're going to take the next best available player. And they were 4th in rebounds. She's a 6'5 forward, so she's going to suck up some rebounds in the WNBA. And they're also 8th in assists, which she can assist. She's real good at assisting and also for shooting, so it's going to help them offensively. with assists, with rebounds. That's just an all-around good pick. But then third, Skylar Diggins to Tulsa. They didn't really have a shot. It didn't leave them much of a choice because the top three in the draft were Griner, Deladon, and Diggins. So when it got to the third pick, Diggins, obviously the best player left. And then Taylor Hill went to the Washington Mystics, who Taylor Hill, not really a player that was talked about a lot in the draft or coming up to the draft, but 20.4 points per game in the Big Ten. Not too shabby, right?
That's pretty good. You can't complain with something like that. Back to Tulsa, Diggins, while I do like her, she's going to be good. I just don't see her making an immediate impact the same way that Dawn and Griner will with their respective teams. Taylor Hill, she might make an impact, but, you know, Washington isn't a very good team in general. I don't know how they went 5-29 and got the fourth pick. That's the worst I've ever seen, you know? It's like they needed the most help, you know? They ended the season, probably thought they were going to get Griner, and didn't get any of the big three. So it'll be rough for her. She might be able to pad some stats, but in the end, she definitely got the worst situation out of all of them.
Yeah, I think one thing that you can focus on, though, she's second in free throws made and second in free throw attempts. So obviously she's going to be tough to stop, and she's a 5'10 guard, so you're going to up your assists a little bit with Taylor Hill. But defensively, that's what kind of scares me. They're ninth in defense. They need a ton of help defensively. They need a ton of help offensively, which she can add offensively, so they shouldn't finish last again. But defense really wins games, and that's what is really going to be the key for Washington to turn it around, is can their defense improve? And I don't think with a 5'10 guard, you're really going to be able to get a lot of rebounds, which they're second to last, and improve defensively, which they rank ninth. So as far as the WNBA goes, that's what we got. The top four picks, not real surprising for me, because since Chicago got the second pick, I thought Diggins might be able to go second, but since it was Chicago picking second, Deladon, not really a surprise. And the way it shaped up, Griner 1, Deladon 2, Diggins 3, Taylor Hill 4. Not a big surprise. And I think Chicago definitely should be a playoff team this year, adding Deladon. We saw how Deladon turned around Delaware. They were never even in the top 25. They were never a basketball school. Deladon went there. They made the tournament. They were ranked top 10 while she was there. So, hey, I mean, I think she's going to make an immediate impact. The rest of them, Griner will make an immediate impact. The last two, we'll have to sit back and see how that turns out. So, next, the Mariners. Are the Mariners in big trouble?
It depends on how you feel about the Mariners, because I went into this season the same way I went into last season, and that's to not have very big expectations for the Mariners. They just don't have the firepower to hang with Oakland, Los Angeles, and the Rangers right now. Their hitting is atrocious. There's no denying that. I can't explain Dustin Ackley hitting 145 with one RBI on the season. No home runs. I can't explain Smoke still hitting in the big leagues, flirting with 200 again. I can't explain signing Jason Bay, and he's hitting in the 200s, the low 200s. And Jesus Montero has two RBIs on the season, maybe.
Now, how much does Jesus Montero weigh? Is it more than he's batting, or is it less than he's batting?
Oh,
that's what I want to know.
Much more. Much more than he's batting. Everybody on the Mariners team is hitting terribly. Even Michael Morse. Yeah, he's hitting home runs, all solo home runs. He has 6 home runs, 10 RBIs, and he's hitting like 260 right now.
And did you notice who the man that drew 2 walks for Detroit was the other night and came around, got on base, and got a huge welcoming applause from the crowd? Do you remember who that was?
Who was that?
It was Matt Tuiasosopo, who was with the Mariners, didn't really produce. So what did they do? After a couple games on the Mariners, they ship him out somewhere else, and now he's producing. He's hitting about 360 with Detroit. So,
man.
You know, Doug Fister pitched super well the other night, and he's looking real good this year. 3-0, Doug Fister. And Furbush, I'm pretty sure, got the loss against Detroit. So I think that's just the story of the Mariners. They're just not real good at guessing who's going to be good and really valuing the potential coming up. They think somebody's going to be real good. They make it a huge deal, and then all of a sudden they come out and hit like 150 and keep them in the big leagues. I don't really understand how the Mariners are that bad at judging talent.
I don't understand it. We have so many players in our farm system that could come up and play a lot better than what we're seeing right now. And to me, their 5-11 record is a lot better than they should be doing with the way they've been hitting. They have one player hitting over 300 that doesn't even play every day. I don't know what to say about this team. They just never seem to get it done. And changes have to be made.
That's true. And then looking at the Angels, do you think the Angels are in trouble, or do you think the Angels will make a comeback?
The difference between the Angels and the Mariners is that the Angels have a slow start and they have good players offensively. The thing that's holding the Angels back so far this season is their terrible pitching. Vargas, who was a fan favorite with the Mariners, is playing terrible right now. Jared Weaver just hit the DL. And Joe Blanton is pitching terrible as well. So,
but then we see Josh Hamilton, who's doing an Albert Pujols from last year. He's not even hitting 200 last I checked. So is he going to kind of come around like Pujols did after the All-Star break? Or is Josh Hamilton just kind of not finding his stride right now and never going to come around?
I think the big problem with the Angels offense is not Albert and it's not Josh Hamilton, but it's that Mike Trout hasn't really gotten started like he did last year. Like last year, Mike Trout probably had one of the best rookie seasons of all time. And a lot of the times when they would win or to mask how bad Albert was doing, it would be because Trout was just playing phenomenal. And now that Trout is not playing phenomenal to start the season, everybody always has a finger to point whenever you're not winning. And, you know, it's, well, what did they spend too much on Albert? Did they spend too much on Hamilton? Or, you know, Trout's not making that much yet, so it can't be his fault. But if he's going to be the star of this team, he has to come and produce like he's the star. And he doesn't have time to have a sophomore slump because there's nobody else that can fill his position. Hamilton can't produce like the old Hamilton. He's getting up there in age. And I'm not saying that he's old, but he's not, you know, a 21-year-old phenom. Same with Albert. Albert is not, you know, the 100-run, 30-home-run, and 100-RBI guy that was up for MVP every season. He's not that type of player anymore. So if Trout is going to be the MVP caliber and be the face of this organization going forward, he needs to be that every day. And if he's not that, then this is the type of Angels that you'll see. But I think that they'll heat up when the summer comes along and, you know, they get more home games. They've also started the season pretty rough. They started off the season with Cincinnati, which, you know, they're the reigning NL Central champs. Then they went to Texas and got beat up over there. And then I can't really explain them getting pretty much swept by the Twins. They would have got swept if that last game didn't get postponed, but they've turned it around. They beat the Tigers the last 2 days by a total score of 18-1. So, you know, things are looking up for them. Trout just hit a grand slam today, his first of his career, which is pretty cool. You know, going forward, we'll see how it goes. How about you? What do you think of them?
Yeah, they're 6-10 right now. Everyone kind of freaked out about it, saying that it was their worst start since the California Angels in the 1960s. That was kind of depressing for LA Angels fans, but at the same time, they got off to a rough start last year. Pujols wasn't hitting real well. Everyone kind of freaked out, and then all of a sudden, they started making a playoff push toward the end of the season. So I think this is typical Angels baseball. Usually they start out real slow, and then eventually when it nears September and October, they start playing real well, and they'll be about 2 or 3 games out of first or a wild card, and everyone starts going to the game, getting excited. So I think keep an eye on the Angels. I think they could potentially come back. The Mariners, I just don't see them turning anything around based on what they have been doing. And their pitching kind of scares me too. Saunders, he's all right. Felix, obviously very good. One guy that I think best pitcher on the team so far, Iwakuma, he's looked real good. And his ERA
the bear
is just awesome right now, under 2. So I think if Iwakuma can keep pitching well, Felix can keep pitching well, I think the Mariners could potentially stay a few games under 500 toward the end of the season, finish a few games under 500. Kind of disappointing, but hey, you don't really have much more to back that up. You have Bevin in the pen, and their starting role is just, it's up for grabs. So, I don't know. Iwakuma, Felix, obviously good pitchers as of right now. Everyone else, not really impressed. And
how do you feel about Wilhelmsson?
I think he looked pretty good. He pitched the 9th and the 10th the other night against Detroit. Looks pretty solid. His fastball looks real good. If he can command his fastball, if he has good control, he's a good pitcher. So I think if you keep working with him, make him the everyday closer. A lot of people aren't really happy with him closing, but I don't know what other choice the Mariners have at this point. So I think Wilhelmsson is a good choice for the Mariners as a closer.
I like Wilhelmsson too. Wilhelmsson has grown on me, but he's really thrown a wrench into the Mariners' relief pitching staff, if you will. You know, I really think that they invested a lot into Pryor and Capps, and although Pryor had just hit the DL, Wilhelmsson's pitched really well. He gets outs and doesn't give up runs. I mean, in the closer role, that's exactly what you need. I mean, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right? So Capps and Pryor are maybe are the future of the Mariners, but I figured that Wilhelmsson would be one of those one-and-done guys, like, you know, like a J.J. Putz or a David Ardsma. The Mariners always had that closer that would do good for a year, and then they'd ship him off somewhere, and then he'd be no good, or, you know, he'd be Brandon League. You know, I hope Wilhelmsson continues to progress and becomes a solid closer for the Mariners, and him, Felix, and, you know, whoever else, Iwakuma, whoever else steps up, they always have a nice pitching staff. The Mariners always have, you know, one of the best pitching staffs in the league, and what really holds them back is their inability to hit the ball, and it's really disappointing to see the Mariners, you know, one season in after moving in the fences, and they're still can't hit the ball. You know, I never thought that moving the fences in would help them. I watched every game the Mariners played last season, and I don't recall any balls that the Mariners hit going to the wall that, you know, got robbed. Or, man, if the fences were moved in those 2 extra feet, that would have been out of here. You know, it's not that. They're just hitting grounders and striking out. You know, this, it's not like they're, you know, to the warning track, and, you know, the players are jumping over the wall and making Ken Griffey Jr. catches.
Mike Trout catches.
Exactly. So, I never understood why they brought the fences in, because that's what made Safeco Field Safeco Field. It was pitcher friendly, and it still is, in my opinion, especially when the Mariners are hitting. So,
yeah, and I didn't think I'd ever see a 14-inning game end up 2-1.
Man.
Felix went 8 innings, no earned runs, got a no decision. Scherzer went, I believe, 7 or 8 innings, 1 earned run. He got a no decision. And it was just kind of up in the air who was going to get the win at that point. They kept rotating pitchers. Detroit used 9 pitchers in that game. Seattle, I think they used 6 or 7. And it turned out 2-1 in favor of Detroit on a poor base running mistake at the end of the game, if you could call it. Blame the third base coach for that one, for sending him. He was out by 10 to 15 feet, and that wasn't even close at the plate. But 2-1 and 14, that just says low offensive game. And I think for Detroit, they were ranked first in the league coming into the game in batting average. So it's not that they couldn't hit. It's that Felix had a very good game, and then the bullpen kind of picked up after him. But as far as the Mariners went, Scherzer struck out 12, and then the bullpen came in. We saw Al Albuquerque strike out 3 in 7 batters that he faced. So I think the pitching was just real good that day. But at the same time, the Mariners just scoring 1 run in 14 innings. That's kind of scary going up against Scherzer and Detroit's bullpen, based on the fact that Porcello gave up 9 2/3 of an inning today. And yesterday, Detroit gave up 8 runs after Sanchez was pulled from the game. So Detroit's bullpen, vulnerable. We saw Villarreal go scoreless. He didn't even pitch an inning. He walked two, and then they got out of it on that double play. And also Dotel, he pitched. When Dotel or Villarreal come into the game for Detroit, it's pretty much over. Other teams jump on them. The Mariners didn't. They drew walks. They couldn't move up the base runners. And that's the story of the Mariners. So I think it's real bad if you're a Mariners fan and it's not looking up. But, hey, you got a big scoreboard, right? Big screen.
And especially if you want to gauge how your team's doing, you want to go up against the best. And last year, the Tigers were the best in the American League. So, you know, to lose a game like that is, it's got to be discouraging, not only for the fans and the organization, but personally for King Felix. Felix, eventually he's going to get tired of receiving no run support because this isn't the first year. He had his Cy Young year. And, you know, he just signed his contract, but how long can he go with the Mariners not producing behind him? You know, he's going to want to get out like Ichiro, like Griffey and A-Rod and all the other superstars that came to Seattle. He's going to want to leave too to, you know, go to a winner. Nobody wants to play for a loser. Yeah, the money's good, but, you know, in the end, when you have enough money, what do you want? A ring. Can the Mariners provide that with their feature lineup, do you think?
No, absolutely not. They can't even make the playoffs, and they haven't made the playoffs for the last 11 years. They should be the 12th year. I'm kind of predicting this based on how they look. Sure, they signed Felix, and then after that, there's no other hitters to back it up, and they're like, oh, yeah, we're a young team, you know, stay with us. We kind of have stuck around for the last 11 or 12 years while you guys kind of fiddle around with young players that never do anything. So we're young is not really an excuse.
Exactly.
If you don't produce. So I feel like you can blame the organization, you can blame the hitters, you can blame whoever, but the pitching and Felix, you can't point the finger at them. So I don't know. I think like Wedge does a good job with what he has. So I don't think it's the manager's fault. And we always see the Mariners firing their manager and hiring new ones. It's not really the manager's deal. I think it's more the front office, the organization, and the hitting.
Speaking of not being able to hang your hat on the youth anymore, you know, I've talked about my dislike for Justin Smoke. And not that I dislike him, but to be the main player in the Cliff Lee deal, you have to do something by now. Cliff Lee hasn't been in Seattle for, what, 3 years now, and you haven't done anything for 3 years in Seattle. So, you know, we know that his time has come. So I'm done talking about Justin Smoke. My problem is Dustin Ackley. How do you feel about Dustin Ackley?
Is there a way to feel about Dustin Ackley? Because right now I haven't really felt anything but disappointed in Dustin Ackley since he's been on the Mariners. And I mean, he had the end of that 1 year that he came here. He was pretty good. He was looking pretty good. And then ever since then, it's just been like, ugh.
Why hasn't looked anything like it.
Yeah, why do we have Dustin Ackley still in the lineup? And you're better off, this is going to sound kind of, I don't know, not a lot of people aren't really going to agree with me, but you're better off cutting the guy or sending him to the AAA Tacoma and calling up somebody else rather than have Ackley and Smoke sit in your lineup. You might as well rotate some players in and trade for some talent if you're going to keep them in the roster or on the roster. You might as well cut both of them and sign somebody else because other players aren't going to be able to do as bad as them. So if you can hit 200, it's a benefit for you, right?
And that's what I don't understand. You can't have Ackley hitting 145 and then Brandon Ryan, who is my least favorite hitter in the entire world, hitting 161 at shortstop. Yeah, he might be a great defender, but in a lineup that can't produce already, you can't have the worst hitter of all time in that lineup.
Well, what signs big contracts anyway? Is it defense or is it the bat?
The bat does.
The bat does, exactly.
And so that's exactly why we didn't get Fielder and we didn't get Josh Hamilton, because they see that this is our lineup. They see that, you know, they'll be hitting before Jesus Montero and they'll be hitting after Sean Figgins type characters, you know, and if I'm looking at that and I want to win a ring and, you know, I'm at the end of my career or, you know, towards the end of my prime, there's no way I'm going to join a team like that.
No way.
You can move the fences into 300 feet if you want to. There's no way I'm going to be on a team like that.
Okay, so if you're looking for a team to play for, say the Yankees or somebody that you feel that you can go play for and win a championship offers you like $400,000 or $500,000, then the Mariners offer you $2 million to come play for them and you know you're not going to win, would you take less money for a championship?
It depends on where I am in my career. If I've made my money and I have nothing to prove, I have money saved up, then I would easily take a pay cut and go play somewhere else. And that's easy for me to say because I'm not in the situation where, you know, I have those expensive bills that those players have. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but, you know, when you live a certain lifestyle, you can't take a pay cut to win a championship. You know, you still have to support your family, and I understand that. I'm not saying that you should take that much money, but, you know, I can't blame you. I would do the same thing, and so would everybody else. So,
yeah.
You know, but for a team that I think that I would join that is on the cusp of, you know, being a contender would be probably either the Orioles or Cincinnati. I think, you know, they've got a lot of good stuff going on at the major league level. Leitos has really stepped up and is becoming the ace of their staff, and he's becoming a household name. They've got Zach Cozart at shortstop, he's not the best. He's not even top 10, but he's solid. He's a lot better than Brendan Ryan is, you know. Having hit him behind Zach Cozart wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. But they also have, you know, Billy Hamilton, who could be the next Ricky Henderson, and he's not even in the big league roster yet. So him, Votto, and
Brandon Phillips.
Beto Phillips. They have a lot of they got a lot of talent coming up, and you know, I think personally, Aroldis Chapman is the best closer in the game.
But isn't he a starter now?
No, he's still closer.
Is he?
Yeah.
Because there's some talk that they were going to move him to a starter. But
yeah, he was going to be their fifth starter, but they kept him as a closer.
Okay, that's a good move if they kept him as a closer.
Yeah. I still think he's going to throw out his arm. But
yeah, he probably will. You can't be like a Joel Zumaya type player and throw 100 and 101 miles an hour and expect to stay in the league for 10 years or so. Yeah. So I don't know. I think he's a good pitcher, but where's Joel Zumaya right now? Is he just gone? Yeah, I think so. Pretty sure his arm exploded somewhere. Said it's playing Guitar Hero or a box fell on it or something stupid, but who knows? So maybe Chapman, his arm's just going to fly off during a pitch. What do you think?
I hope not. That would be the worst. But who would you play for if you had to choose between two teams?
Obviously, I'd choose the Tigers first because that's my go-to, but I think someone to look at right now is Oakland because they're real good with dealing with young talent and bringing up young players that maybe they don't have the biggest payroll, but then they kind of still produce, and they're better than the Mariners year after year. They made the playoffs last year, looking solid this year. So I think if Oakland were to offer me a contract, I'd go with it because I like the chances of not only making the playoffs, but they could, one of these years down the road, win a title, I think. So I think Oakland, Detroit, and let's see, I'll pick a National League team. I guess I'll go with the Giants for the National League because defending champs, and they're always kind of fun to watch, and sometimes their pitching's a little shaky, but then their offense picks up for it. Sometimes their offense isn't producing, but their pitching picks up. So I don't know.
And I feel like they're underrated.
Yeah, they are.
Offense is always underappreciated, and their pitching staff is by far the best in the league.
Yeah, that's true. And I think as far as the National League goes, they are the best team in the National League. The Dodgers, I think, could be somebody to watch. They're kind of hitters off to a slow start, including Matt Kemp, but they should be able to come back once they get Greinke back and they start heating up. They're kind of like the Angels.
Yeah.
They'll get there eventually, but will it be enough to make the playoffs is the question.
How do you feel about the Rockies?
The Rockies are kind of a team that they're kind of out there right now, but I don't really know if they can really do much, but I think they could make the playoffs this year. Obviously, they have the benefit of playing at a high altitude, so they can hit the ball farther than anyone else when they're at home. And if you're playing somebody like the Mariners at home, you're going to have a substantial advantage because Mariners can't hit the ball. The Rockies just make contact, and the ball flies out of the ballpark. So I think that's one thing to watch out for with the Rockies. I think they could potentially be a good offensive team because of the elevation. They could hit a lot of home runs. But at the same time, I'm not real sure how they're going to match up with the rest of the league. So I think even if they do make the playoffs, I don't really see them getting past like a San Francisco or maybe even like a Cincinnati. But I don't know. I think the Rockies are kind of up in the air right now, and I don't really know if I can sell the Rockies to somebody if I were to try to convince them that the Rockies are going to win the World Series.
I don't think that they'll win the World Series, but I think the youth and rebuilding that they have going on right now is a lot better than what the Mariners have going on. You know, I feel like they have some things to fall back on offensively. Pitching-wise, they're not the greatest pitching team, I'll give you that. The Mariners definitely have a very large competitive advantage in pitching than the Rockies do. But the Rockies have a lot more offensively, and they'll win more games than the Mariners.
So they're going to win more than 50 games? Oh, I'm sorry, that was mean. I think the Mariners will win at least 65, Mariners fans. So everyone that's a Mariners fan out there listening to this,
they won't have 100 losses, I'll give you that.
No, they won't, but they'll be close. They probably will be close.
All right, that just about wraps it up. I'm Brian Duchesne. He's Corey Sullivan. We'll catch you next time on the Revolutionary Sports Show.
Bring the action. When you have this in the club.